Well, it has been a great pleasure to do some research on our speaker, Miss Robin. It's going to be an honor for you all to listen to her story of recovery. And it's great for her to be here on opening night of this great convention. I want to thank her for her service and dedication to this fellowship. Since I didn't really know Robin and won't get to hug her after the meeting and tell her about how much I appreciate and learn so much from her talk, I decided to listen to her on YouTube the other night, just a little bit, so I would get to know her a little bit. And of course, I listened to the whole talk, and well, you all are in for a treat. So with chills going up and down my spine and tears in my eyes, I'm going to just hand the mic over to Miss Robin and let you listen. Thank you, Robin.
Thank you, Karen. Thank you, Liz. My name is Robin Vernon. I'm a very grateful member of Al-Anon. I'm coming to you from Winston-Salem, North Carolina, actually Clemens, which is a little southwest of Winston-Salem. But, and I am on speaker view. Is there any way I can get on Gallery, whoever is controlling that?
Yes, absolutely.
I do not want to see my life-size self during this whole meeting. I need to see some of the people.
You can change your view locally there to gallery view up in the top right-hand corner.
Right, but it won't give me... there we are. Okay, that's what I want. Okay. Well, it keeps switching back. What is it?
Sorry, I've got to spotlight you for everyone, and then you can go do that, and then you should see gallery view. Sorry.
Okay, there we go. Perfect. I think they're doing this on purpose, y'all, but... I would like to thank the committee. It's always a great honor and a privilege to be asked to do this. And Liz has kept me well informed, and I'm grateful for that. This is never my favorite thing to do, but I do find it very challenging on Zoom. So anybody that is willing to keep their picture up, I would be very grateful. It's really hard to talk to a bunch of names and Garfield and whatever that picture is, which is quite lovely, but the feedback is not quite the same looking out there. So anybody that is willing to show me themselves, I'd be very grateful, and I won't take offense at anything you do, trust me. So when Lois Wilson was asked what she did in the moment of silence before the Serenity Prayer at a meeting, she said she invited the God of her understanding to the meeting. So I would really be grateful if everybody would have just another moment of silence, and each individual or group, please invite the God of your understanding to the meeting. Thank you. Amen. Thank you. Okay. The chances of me getting in trouble just decrease exponentially. Okay. And if I understand correctly, I have till 8:30. Is that right, Liz? Or thereabouts, a few minutes? Okay. All right. My home group is the Help and Hope Al-Anon Family Group in Winston-Salem. We meet at 5 p.m. on Zoom every Saturday. That's 5 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Help and Hope in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. And we're a step study group, and I'm very, very grateful for that group. They're my family of choice. You all, I know a few of you, I can never find everybody, but even the people I've never laid eyes on, you understand me better than my family of origin does. You're my family of choice. You are what I need to recover. So I appreciate you suiting up and showing up. My family of origin, I'm the oldest of four girls. My mom and dad, Bill and Jackie, they did a lot more right than they did wrong. Lovely people, good people, hardworking people. They're both gone now, unfortunately. And they were teetotalers. For anybody that isn't aware of it, drinking is a sin, okay? That's the kind of family I grew up in. It's a sin to consume alcohol. And one of the effects of the disease on me has been the fact that I'm a bit rebellious. Not like I used to be, but in the beginning, if they said, don't do that, it's a sin, I immediately started trying to figure out how I was going to accomplish it, you know? And I don't think my mom died, either one of them ever took a swallow of any kind of alcohol. However, they each had an alcoholic in their family of origin. So that means they were affected by the family disease of alcoholism. And so I was affected at birth. Okay, four girls and all four of us married alcoholics. Now we are well beyond fluke and coincidence into pattern there. And I do believe being affected by this disease early on made me predisposed to an attraction to alcoholics. I am basing that on some firsthand knowledge. a lot of firsthand knowledge. So the way I describe my disease, it is the isms of alcoholism. And for me today, that stands for internal spiritual malady. Okay. I was born with it, as far as I know, that internal spiritual malady. I didn't fit anywhere. I wasn't tall enough. I'm only 5'2". I wasn't pretty enough. I wasn't smart enough. I just wasn't enough. I just was not enough. And I understand today that that is the effects of the family disease of alcoholism. I came here originally because I was married to an active alcoholic. And I want to tell you about our first date. That will kind of set the tone. I knew him since junior high school. And we had, I think, one class together, but I actually saw him in the principal's office more than I did in class, because he and I were kind of, well, we acted out. Let's just put it like that. And I can't go in, but there's some, you know, stories. But we didn't have our first date till we were juniors in high school. And he asked me out to a party, and I said, yes, we went to the party. It was actually in Clemens, not too far from my mom and dad's home. I thought we had a great time. And then when we went home, he scared me to death driving home. And so I was very grateful when we got in the driveway in one piece. And then he asked me out for the next day. And I said, sure, yeah, I'd like that. And so that's kind of the first inkling that there's something going on here outside of what could be a healthy relationship. A healthier person, perhaps someone not affected by the family disease of alcoholism, would have said, no, Pat, all I need tonight, don't call me, I'll call you. But that's not what I said. And so the next day, when it came time for him to come pick me up, he didn't show. He stood me up on our second date Turns out the reason he scared me driving home was because he was in a blackout. He didn't know that he had asked me out for a second date. So he called later that afternoon, and I blessed him out and hung up on him. And 15 minutes later, the doorbell rang, and there he was. And he said, "You want to go to Tanglewood Park?" And I said, "Yeah, let's go. Let's go." And we were off and running, wide open. Our illnesses attracted us to one another, and they prospered together, I'll tell you. So Dave and I, we fell in sick long before we fell in love. We fell in sick, and then we learned to love one another very deeply. We were married at 23, and then we were separated by 29. And, you know, all I can tell you is that I began to see how his drinking was out of control. I always drank with him. I partied with him. I drank not a lot because I was so small, but I did a lot of drugs, recreational drugs. I mean, I partied with him. And, when I started losing control, that was it for me. Unless I really got out of hand early, and then I would just usually go to sleep. But, you know, the first time I remember trying to control his drinking, it was, I said, "Let's just party on weekends. Let's not party during the week." And of course he said, "Okay, sure." And I found out later that he would leave his stash, his cooler and whatever, at Marty's house, a couple of doors up, and he would pick it up on his way out. And, you know, it just never could control it. But he walked off a job at R.J. Reynolds Tobacco Company. There, a lot of you may not have heard of that, but it was a place to work at this time in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. And he had worked years to get on there, and he walked off that job. And he got a new job almost immediately, a really good job. And then I found him drinking a beer in the shower one morning at 7 o'clock before his new job. And that's when really the bells started ringing and the warning lights started flashing. And so I practiced detachment, which I didn't even know that word, but I did the only thing I knew how to do. I kicked him out of the house and changed the locks. Okay. I do not recommend that. If there are any newcomers on here, please don't do that. Go to 6 meetings and listen, take the cotton out of your ears and put it in your mouth. That's what my first sponsor told me. And then after that 6 meeting, decide if you want to stay or not. And she also told me, and if you don't want to stay, we will happily refund your misery. Okay. She was a black belt Al-Anon. What can I say? So what happened pretty much was I kicked him out of the house. He went through all his friends, his family, and then his brother, who was a Winston-Salem police officer, put him in treatment on his birthday. And so he called me from a treatment center and he said, "I'm right where I need to be." And he said, "Would you like to go to an Al-Anon meeting?" And I said, "What's that?" And he said, "That's where the family members go to recover, like we go to AA to recover." And I said, "Recover what?" Because I was not aware that I had a problem. I had gotten rid of my problem, and that was an alcoholic husband. There was nothing wrong with me but him. And if he would just do what I told him to do or not do what I told him not to do, I'd be fine. There was nothing wrong with me. And I will tell you, that was 9 years before I walked into my first Al-Anon meeting. I wouldn't have heard a thing if I had come, you know. I do believe we all get here right on time. you know, he came into AA, he said all the way down, he became a member in good standing, and I liked what I saw. And so we reconciled, we got a new home, which we moved, we literally moved the house that I sit in today and remodeled it. And we moved back in there. And, you know, I remember the first time I heard our three C's. You know, I did not cause it, I cannot control it, and I cannot cure it. And I thought, well, I never thought that I caused his alcoholism. But I look back from where I sit today, and I remember when we moved in this house, you know, we had a big walk-in closet, and I had shelves for my shoes, and I was going to keep them all nice and lined up. Some of them were even in the boxes, you know. I was going to keep this house cleaner. I was going to cook dinner every night. You know, I had a new job. I made more money. And the subconscious thought after each one of those things was, and he won't have to drink. And he won't have to drink. So on a level, I didn't even understand. I did believe that I caused his alcoholism. I had a fourth C. I did not cause it. I cannot control it. And I cannot cure it. But I sure did contribute. And I contributed with this mouth and with a stinking attitude, a really bad attitude. Another thing my first sponsor would say, she said, Robin, and it was always this question is for you, not for me. I don't need to know the answer. Robin, attitudes are contagious. Is yours worth catching? And no, the answer was no. You know, she already knew that, but she wanted to be sure I knew that, you know. And the way I contributed was I was on him like a duck on a June bug. I mean, I had him like a bug under a magnifying glass all the time, you know. And I remember Sue D from California, longtime Al-Anon member. When she talks, she tells about the little man that came and 12-stepped her husband to his first AA meeting. And on the way out the door, he turned around and he pointed at her and he said, you're just as sick as he is. And he cannot stay sober coming home to an old idea. And I proved that in my house. I remember very clearly, David was sober. He was probably sober 5 years when we moved in this house together, got it ready and moved in. And I remember saying, why are you still going to those meetings? You know, you hadn't had a drink in over 5 years. Why aren't you still hanging out with those people? And I was so ignorant about the disease of alcoholism that I did not know that his life depended on his hanging out with those people. So I was definitely part of the problem, not part of the solution. I came home one day, David had been sober. I came home from work one day, he'd hurt his back. He'd gone to his primary care physician and he had hooked him up in the worst way, including a Demerol shot. And so he was actually in a blackout when I came home. And that started about 2 years of the worst insanity that I've ever lived in. And to be honest with you, I was probably 95% of it. My disease kicked in a way that I had never experienced. You know, I do believe, I understand the alcoholic's obsession, the craving and the obsession that this allergy, this chemical reaction causes. And today I'm crystal clear on my obsession with the alcoholic. And I had it bad. And you know, I did a lot of things. I just want to qualify myself briefly. I did a lot of search and find, a lot of search and find every day, every night. There was a duffel bag in the basement. It was David's. I searched that duffel bag at least once every day because he always put what he was trying to sneak and use in that duffel bag. And so I would always find it and I would take it to him. I had three goals. The first goal is, got you. Because this illusion of control was very important. You know, this illusion is quite difficult to perpetuate. Now, I didn't know it was an illusion then. I'm crystal clear on that today. But got it. Don't you think you're getting anything over on me, buddy? And then the second goal was to make him tell the truth. Okay. And you all know how you can tell if an active alcoholic is lying. His lips are moving. You know, I mean, it didn't matter what I found or where I found it. I found other things in other places. He never knew what it was and he never knew where it came from. And there were just two of us that lived here. So the third thing I tried to accomplish was really, I wanted him to say what I wanted him to say. And you know, I heard a speaker, an Al-Anon speaker say, the alcoholic does not hear a thing that the Al-Anon says. He watches what we do. Okay. And I was doing the same thing over and over and over and over, expecting different results. This time he'll hear me. This time he'll get it, you know. And he says, the Al-Anon doesn't pay any attention really to what the alcoholic's doing. The Al-Anon just wants the alcoholic to say what they want to hear. And that's what I wanted. I wanted him to say, honey, I'll go back to those meetings. Now I was begging him, please go back and hang out with those people. Because I knew that's where he'd found his help. I wanted him to say, I'll go back, honey. I love you. I won't do it again. I'll go back to AA. And that just didn't happen, you know. So I called his family doctor, okay, because I felt like he needs to know what's going on. He was giving him all these different prescriptions. He's putting all these multitude of pills in an unmarked Tylenol bottle and carrying them around. He doesn't even know what anything is or how to take it. And he was really crazy. And so I called the doctor. He took my call. I explained the situation. He said, well, I really appreciate you calling. I will not be giving him any more medication. Pretty soon another bottle showed up full of pills. So I kept calling the doctor. And pretty soon, not surprising, he didn't want to talk to me anymore. I remember very clearly writing him a letter. I will explain it to him one more time, this time in black and white. And again, I'm doing the same thing over and over, expecting different results. That definition of insanity. And, you know, I look back on that. Now, who do you think the doctor thought was insane in this equation? Okay. I mean, seriously, I'm sure he was saying, oh my goodness, if I was married to that woman, I would be needing something for my nerve. I would be having some muscle spasms. I'd be having some headaches. I'd be having trouble sleeping. I mean, he had pills for everything. So the final thing, I had started having some physical symptoms myself. You know, my first sponsor, she always stressed to me, and I have since seen this, she always stressed to me that our disease, the family disease of alcoholism, is just as terminal as the alcoholic. And she always said, Robin, Al-Anons get parts taken out. The stress will kill us a teaspoon at a time. And I've seen that. And I've felt that because at this point in this insanity, I was having some jaw pain. So I went to the dentist and told him, and he checked my teeth and he said, your teeth look fine today. Do you think you're grinding your teeth? No, I'm not grinding my teeth. So then I was having some ear pain. So I went to my family doctor and because I had had ear infections very early on because I lived in the water. But anyway, he checked my ear and he said, Robin, I don't see anything wrong with your ear. It looks fine. Do you think you might grind your teeth? No, I don't grind my teeth. Back to the dentist. And I know there is something wrong here with my teeth. So x-rays. And he said, Robin, your x-rays look good. Everything looks good. Are you sure you don't grind? I do not grind my teeth. And, you know, I was like a tightly wound clock spring, overwhelmed clock. I suffer from, I had something I call BTTT, bow tied too tight. I was just a rager. I mean, I remember clearly wanting to pull a young girl across the counter at a Taco Bell over a burrito. I was going to kill this girl over a burrito. I mean, it just, you know, I can't keep that kind of resentment, anger and resentment compartmentalized. It spills over into every area of my life. And it was doing just that. So my primary care gave me Clonopin. Now this might be the sickest thing I say all night. He gave me Clonopin, which of course there was nothing wrong with me. I refused to take them, but I put them in the medicine cabinet right beside David's shaving cream. So he would see them every day, like bait, when he shaved, and I counted them every morning and every night to be sure he was not taking them. Okay. And some of us are sicker than others, and I'm some of the some, I'm telling you. But that illusion of control, that need to know, you know, today I understand that a need to know is a need to control. And if I had to use one word to describe my disease, it would be control. So December 29th. Of 1992, I ran out of good ideas. The only reason I know the date is because it was my daddy's birthday. I had just had probably the worst Christmas I'd ever had in my life. And even though David guilt balked everything I think I mentioned I might like for 6 months, it was very inappropriate how many presents I got. And I remember sitting on the floor right over there and just weeping as I opened them, as miserable as I have ever been. And I heard him at 6 a.m. that morning down in the basement in a 30-gallon trash can. Now I knew at all times where he was. Like I was like a ninja, you know, I could hear. We live in, it's our house, this house, now my house is, I don't know how old it might be 88 years old now. It has old heart pine floors. So they squeak, and he could go in the walk-in closet and I could hear that squeak like at 3 o'clock in the morning if he snuck upstairs. And so I'd wait till he went downstairs and then I would get up and I'd go in and find that squeak, put my hand in the coat pocket and gotcha. I mean, seriously, it was bad. I mean, this was how I lived. It was awful. So I heard him in that trash can downstairs, but he was not in the trash over by the door. He was in the back corner where he kept a 30-gallon trash can full of bird seed. And I knew he wasn't feeding the birds at 6 a.m. So I didn't do anything then. I didn't do anything. I did not run down there and search and find. I was different. I ran out of good ideas, I think. I looking back on it, I believe it was a God that I didn't know, didn't use, doing for me what I could not do for myself. He came upstairs and passed out on the couch. That afternoon, and I went down to the 30-gallon birdseed trash can, and flipped the lid up, and there were a lot of little empty vodka bottles, airplane bottles. And so I took one and I came upstairs and I sat down across the room from him, and I held that up, that empty bottle up, and very gently said his name. Now, in the past, if I found something in the duffel bag at 3 or 4 a.m. and he was asleep in the bed, oh yeah, I was coming upstairs wide open. And I didn't care whether he was asleep or not. He was coming out of that bed. I didn't know where he was sleeping, but I can tell you where he wasn't sleeping. And I was just different. I can't explain it. But I held that empty bottle up and I said, David, I can't do this anymore. And if you want help, I'll support you. Okay. And he chose to go into an outpatient treatment program. And I went to the family program. Now, I want to be crystal clear on why I went. I went to be sure that he went, and I went to be sure that he heard what he needed to hear. And I told him what that was all the way home every night. Okay. They put all of us together in this one room for 4 hours, the first 5 nights. It was patients and families and one counselor. It was a squirrely bunch. It really was. And I remember every night going home talking about him and them. Did you hear what she said? Could you believe that he did? Could you believe that they thought? You know, always talking about him and them. I don't get any better talking about him and them, but I was still holding a magnifying glass. I was holding a magnifying glass. And so the third night we were there, it was a Wednesday night, and we sat down. They'd given us these notebooks, and the counselor is sitting there, same counselor, sitting right in front of me. He says, turn page 47 in your notebook. So I very promptly and perfectly turned to page 47 in my notebook, and I looked over, and David appeared to be struggling. So I reached over and I helped him turn his pages 47. I don't know if I thought he had forgotten his numbers. I don't think I thought. It was just what I did. Among many other things, I was totally not aware of. This is a very intelligent man, much smarter than I am, don't mind telling you. But when I looked up, that counselor was looking at me, and the look on his face, I knew, was the same look I had on my face every night on the way home when I was talking about how sick everybody else in that room was. And he's looking at me like that, like, boy, you are a sick woman. And my mind opened just a crack. And little Miss Perfect just had a shaft of self-awareness come in. And I thought, I don't think I'm okay. I don't think I'm okay. And that moment of clarity, I can't explain that either. A God I did not know doing for me what I could not do for myself. And coincidence that they loaded us in a van and took me to our first Al-Anon meeting? I think not. No. You know, God was bringing me along as fast as I could follow. Very slow starter here. Very slow starter. 9 years after the alcoholic I was married to invited me to Al-Anon, they drove me to my first meeting. I had no choice, honestly. Kudos to anybody that just showed up, had the courage to walk in a meeting and admit that they needed help. I did not. So I came all the way in and sat down, and I came home. I came home to you all. I fit here with you all, like I don't fit anywhere else, ever. My family of origin, sports teams. You know, I played sports all my life. I just never fit anywhere like I fit here. And you all were talking about things I'd been keeping secret for years. And I immediately wanted what you had. And so I started following good orderly direction, you know, and there I had G-O-D, good orderly direction, okay? My first, I found a tool belt, you know, hope. I thought, gosh, they're so comfortable in their skin. You know, I vibrated. I could not sit still. I could not think. I drove everywhere at 80 miles an hour. I was just a hazard to myself and everybody near me. But I had hope after being with you all for just that 1 hour, newcomer meeting. And that became the belt, tool belt, that I began hanging tools on. And I asked a lot of questions, you know. This program became a design for living. You know, I didn't get the tools for living pre-Al-Anon. And so I asked a lot of questions, and I got a sponsor. You know, I got a sponsor. And I'll never forget the first thing she suggested to me. She said, it would be a good idea. You know, they don't tell you what to do, but they make very strong suggestions. She said, it would be a good idea if you didn't say anything to David that was judging, accusing, or blaming. No jabbing, no judging, accusing, or blaming. I was willing to go to any lengths. So I took that home and I held everything that was going to come out of my mouth up to that. Is this judging him? Is this accusing him? Is this blaming him? All communication on my part ceased. Okay. I had no idea that for years, everything I had said to this poor man was judging him for something, accusing him of something, blaming him for something. My thinking was so distorted. I thought everything that was wrong in my world was David Vernon's fault. And that was just not true. Just not true. So I went back to her and I said, look, we've got a communication problem at our house now. What can I say? And she said, you can say it if it's loving, true, and necessary. Loving, true, and necessary, but it has to be all three. Well, forget it. I could certainly get true and necessary. Couldn't pull off loving because I had so much anger and resentment and no way to process that healthy. You know, I mean, slamming doors, putting holes in the wall, I threw bar stools and hit him, cups and hit him, threw flower pots at him. He, you know, that was a hard lob, so he got out of the way of that. But, you know, that I was a rager. He was not. I was the one driving like a maniac and raging. If you'd have been on the fly in the wall, if you'd have been a fly on the wall in this house, you would have thought I was the alcoholic because I was much crazier than he was. And I was doing all the wrong things for all the right reasons because I love this man. I love this man. So in early sobriety, there was not a lot of communication, you know. I communicated a lot with my sponsor. She insisted I call her every day. She said, it doesn't matter if you got anything to talk about or not, call me every night. And I did that. And I understand now why I did that. Because when the crisis came, and they always do in the active disease, it was muscle memory. I could pick up that 500-pound phone. She insisted I work the steps. I started working the steps. And, you know, I cruised through. Did my paperwork on the first step, second step, third step, working on that fourth step. And the one I was going to skip, I was never going to tell her everything about me. I was just not, you know, I was not. And so I was going to skip the fifth step. So I got a little hung up on the fourth step. She would ask me, she would say, "How are you coming on that fourth step?" And I'd say, "Good, good. I'm making great progress." And then maybe another week later, she'd say, "How's the fourth step coming?" "Excellent, excellent. It's coming along nicely, coming along nicely." And she just kept asking me, you know, and I was so sick that I had found this list. I don't know if you all have seen the list from Alateen. It's a guideline, I think, an Alateen thing. They may not have it anymore, but it gives all these emotions, you know, and the only thing I could feel was rage and anger. So I went back. I was doing my first four step on the seven most painful events. So I was isolating every emotion I thought I had for every event. And then I was cataloging how many times I had felt this and that. I mean, if I had had another month, maybe I'd have had a colored graph. I don't know. But I made the mistake of telling her the truth. She said, "How are you coming on that fourth step?" And I said, I'm stuck. And she said, "Well, maybe you need to process." Well, I had never heard that one. I thought, yeah, I think I do need to process. And she said, "Well, come over to the house on Saturday. We'll eat lunch and process after lunch." I was like, okay. So I go over to the house that Saturday, and we're sitting at the table having lunch. The phone rings, and I hear her tell another Al-Anon. Now, I'm going to have the ringer on the phone turned off after lunch because I'm going to be taking a fifth step. And I thought, I wonder who's coming over to do a fifth step after I get finished processing. I had no idea. Processing is a fifth step. Hello. She tricked me. She tricked me, you know. And this woman that had known me less than 3 months, she tricked me into doing a fifth step. And to be honest with you, if she had not loved me enough to do that for me, I don't think I would have survived relapse, because it happened 4 months in. And I was not okay. I mean, I had a slip. I had a screaming Mimi slip. And it was, you know, it was bad. It was really, really bad. Even in just that 4 months, his disease had progressed, just like you all had told me. Even if he's not drinking, the disease progresses. So he was immediately really, really bad. And so I got on the phone. She had always told me, before you act out your illness, you pick up that phone and you call me. And so I got her on the phone and I explained it to her. And she said, "What do I do?" And she said, "You treat him like an honored guest in your home." And I said, "Come again?" She said, "You treat him like an honored guest in your home." And I just was speechless, because I had immediately gone into the one of the five M's I thought I didn't have, the Al-Anon salute, you know. Look, I'm going to a meeting every single night. I have a sponsor. I call her every day. I'm working the steps. I mean, look at all I'm doing, and look what he's doing to me. You know, he was still drinking at me. In my mind, he's still drinking at me. Treat him like an honored guest. Seriously. You don't have a better tool than that. I was a rager. And so, finally what she did, because I was really bad. I mean, I was going over the fence in left field, and she could see that, I think. I remember a few things I did that were not pretty. But anyway, she said, "Why don't you come to my house just for this week? Come to my house and stay this week. And then at the end of the week, we'll see what God has planned," you know. And so I did that. And I want to fifth step you right now and tell you that I had done such a good job on my paperwork on the first step that I had been giving David the number of an AA sponsor I had picked out for him from the very beginning. Okay. I had switched this illusion of control to AA and sponsorship. His AA sponsor had a lake house that didn't even have a telephone. And I knew you have got to be able to get a hold of your sponsor 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. I mean, this is serious business. So the number I'd been giving him just happened to be the number for my sponsor's husband. And I'm sure I had an ulterior motive of an information exchange because I still had that need to know, need to control. I mean, it's very clear. So as I was leaving my house, I knew that he was at that bottom that I had heard you all talk about. And I said, I'm going to give him this number one more time and he'll get it this time. So I put Ray's number on a sticky note. And as I was getting in my car in the basement, standing right beside it with the door open, I handed him that note and I said, here's Ray's number. Call him. He can help you. He's been sober a long time. Call him. He can help you. I took one step, got in the car, and I left. And you know, on the way over to my sponsors, I was just raging. I was just raging. Seriously. And at about halfway over there, it's about a 30-minute drive, about halfway over there, I looked down and that sticky note was on the bottom of my shoe. And that is when I made the transfer from here to here on that first step. You know, this is a heart program. It's not a head program. It's not a head program. And it takes life experiences, hard lessons for me to make the transfer from my head to my heart. And that is the instant I made the transfer on that first step. And I do want to say in my own defense, he did call Ray, I don't know when, and I don't know how, because I had the freaking number. It was the first thing I ever put in a God box. My God box became the console in my car. But he did call Ray, and Ray gave him the number for Dennis, who became his sponsor forever and ever. So I had absolutely nothing to do with it, honestly. Absolutely. You know, and my sponsor, if she told me once, she told me a million times, Robin, you are not qualified to help that man. You are not qualified to help him. And, you know, I have to get it like I got to get it. So I want to talk to you about very quickly about when I made the transfer on the third step. You know, I came home at the end of that week and David was not drunk, but I had put down that magnifying glass, admitting powerlessness, making that transfer on that first step. I put down the magnifying glass and I picked up a mirror. And that's really when recovery began for me. Okay. When I started holding a mirror. And so I don't know when he drank or didn't drink. Okay. Because I was practicing detachment the best I could. I was treating him like an honored guest and I was holding a mirror. So I was doing my work. So my disease talks to me, okay? I have no idea when it was, how long it had been, but I can tell you, I came home, I parked the car, I was halfway up the basement steps, he was standing on the floor looking up at me, I have no idea what we were talking about, but my disease said, he's been drinking. And the next thing it said was, it's in the bird seed. And so, boom, that obsession, that need to know, kicked in. And again, before you act out your disease, you pick up that phone and you call me. So I went right upstairs and explained to my sponsor, I just got home and I took one look at him and I'm telling you, he's drinking. I can tell. And I know it's in the birdseed trash can. And I'll never forget what she said. She said, Robin, Your higher power is going to let you know what you need to know when it's time for you to know it, see what you need to see when it's time for you to see it, and hear what you need to hear when it's time for you to hear it. And at this point, I already knew better than to try to talk to her when she was in that frame of mind. Okay. So I just said, okay, fine. I'll see you at the meeting tonight. Okay. So I saw her at a meeting that night. I probably called her after the meeting. Of course, all I wanted to talk about was searching the bird seed. I don't know how many times she said it, but all she said was, your higher power is going to let you know what you need to know when it's time for you to know it, see what you need to see when it's time for you to see it, and hear what you need to hear when it's time for you to hear. So that was a Thursday, went through Friday. And then Saturday morning, David worked at a golf course as a starter. So he went very early, like dark o'clock, to the golf course. Well, he called and woke me at first light, which I was not happy about on a Saturday. And he said, will you do me a favor? And I said, what is it? He said, will you feed the birds for me? And he proceeded to send me down to the 30-gallon trash can of bird seed that I had been obsessing about searching for 2 days. And he went into great detail about how to feed his birds. Well, I couldn't get dressed and down to the bird seed quick enough. And I'm going to tell you, I'll fifth step you again. I dug way deeper than I needed to feed those birds. There was nothing there. There was nothing there. And that's when I made the transfer on the third step. You know, there's three answers to prayer. Yes, no, and wait a while. And I do better with a flat out no than I do wait. I don't do well with delayed gratification. And so I understood that, you know, God's plan and God's timing are perfect, Robin. And if you start manipulating and getting in the way, which you've done for so many years, playing God, this God-like attitude, it does nothing but create insanity. You know, you're not part of the solution when you do that. So there you go. Wait a while. And I managed to. And so that began a process of even deeper work on making that decision to turn my will, which is my thoughts and attitude, and my life, my actions, over to the care of God as I understood him, or misunderstood him, depending on what day it was. So I continued holding the mirror. Now I want to talk to you a little bit about the last time David came home here drunk, all right? So, I mean, I detached big time. I'm just, even today, I am not well enough to spend extended periods of time around an active disease. I'm not. I'm just not, okay? I'm affected. And so he and I didn't have meals together. We didn't go many places together. We didn't do things together, you know. And this was also a Saturday. I cooked dinner. I have no idea why I cooked dinner. I don't know how I cooked dinner. Again, it was God doing for me what I could not do for myself. And so when he came home, I had dinner on the table. Well, he came in the door and very clearly was drunk. I mean, drunk. And smelled like a brewer. Now, in the past, my mouth would be connected to the doorknob. I'd be on him like a duck on a June bug. And I would say something really intelligent like, you've been drinking. And then he would say, no, I have not. And I would say, David Vernon, you know I can always tell when you've been drinking. And boom, I'd be down in that basement. Gotcha. We could just play a tape. We sat down and we had a meal together. I have absolutely no idea what we talked about, but I can tell you what we didn't talk about. We did not talk about the fact that he'd been drinking. Now, the rat was in the cage now. I don't mind telling you. I had that knot in my stomach. My disease was talking to me. The rat was in the cage. And, you know, you all had taught me that it's okay to state my truth. If I do it because I need to do it to be okay. Not to make him do something or not to keep him from doing something, but because I need to state my truth to be okay. And I had also learned to pray, ask God to let me know when to speak up and when to shut up. And if it's time to speak up, that it be his words. And so I was doing the dishes. David's at the table with this deer in the headlights thing going on because I'm different, you know. I mean, it shocked him as much as it did me, perhaps more, because he was always the brunt of my insanity. And I was praying. I was praying as hard as I could pray. And I turned around and I looked at him and I said, Dave, I need to let you know that I'm uncomfortable with the way you are. And that's all that came out of my mouth. And he said, well, I've not been drinking. And I said, stop, please. I'm not going to discuss it with you. I just need to let you know how I feel. Finished the dishes, came in, sat down on the sofa right here. I had a meeting and I couldn't wait to leave for the meeting. And in about 20 minutes, he came in and he sat down and he did the thing I'd been trying to force him to do for years. He said, I drank today. I've hurt you and I'm sorry. As soon as I stopped trying to make him tell the truth, he came right in, sat down and told the truth. Now, what happened for me was, for the first time in all my selfishness and self-righteousness, I saw how bad his drinking hurt him. And I'll tell you, I don't know anything about the pain of the disease of alcoholism. Nothing. Absolutely nothing. I'm grateful I don't. What happened for him, I didn't know until 2 years later. I went to an AA speaker meeting, open AA speaker meeting, and he was the speaker. And when he gave his sobriety date, he said, when I came home drunk on November 22nd of 1993, and my wife didn't go crazy like she always had in the past, I didn't have anything else to look at but me. And I did not like what I saw. And so I found out that all that time I'd been playing God. I'd been knowing best. I'd been managing, manipulating, meddling, martyring, meddling. All that time, I've been standing in his higher power's way. You know, and I see myself standing, you know, just with my hands on my hips, just blah, 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 this mouth going, going, going. And his higher power's tapping me on the shoulder saying, excuse me, that young man needs my help. And if you will step aside, I will help him. And I'm like, no, God, oh, you go help somebody that doesn't have me to help you, you know. The biggest difference between me and God, he never thinks he's me, okay? He does not get confused about that. I still today, after a few 24 hours here, can get confused about that. That knowing best character defect. It's tempered, but it's not wrong. So, okay. In 2009, David called me from another treatment center. Now, we had, after years together in sobriety, we had divorced. We divorced in recovery. We treated one another like honored guests. And I'm always grateful for the tools you gave me during that process, which was hard. We were married for 19 years, but we did divorce. But we would see one another, and I knew I could always call him for anything, and he knew that about me. He was my best friend. And when he called me from that that treatment center in 2009, that's when I began to learn about pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization and how baffling, cunning, powerful, and patient the disease of alcoholism really is. He was just short of 16 years. And, you know, my mom and dad both died of terminal cancer, and I was their primary caregiver. And I will tell you that watching David Vernon fight this disease for 2 years was the ugliest thing I've ever watched in my life. And, you know, we would go out and shoot pool. We'd have dinner and we would shoot pool and just, God, we would have fun and laugh. I mean, we just were best friends, you know. And when I didn't hear from him for a couple of weeks, I would know that he was back out. And I would have to love him from a distance. And treat him like an honored guest, you know. Occasionally he would call. He did call drinking one time. And I said, Dave, I can't talk to you when you're drinking. Let's pray. And I prayed. And he wept. And I told him, David, I love you. You're a good man. You're a good man. And you deserve the very best that God has to offer. And I love you. I got to go. Click. And, you know, every time I talked to him, that's what I would tell him. He came over in September of 2011, and I hadn't seen him for quite a while, and he had been ravaged by the disease. And he told me, Robin, I don't think that I'll live through another relapse. And I told him, I said, Dave, you're a good man, and you deserve the very best that God has to offer. I don't want you to die. I love you. And a month later, I got a call from a dual member in my group, and David had died from the effects of the terminal disease of alcoholism. Now, the miracle in all this is that I took no more dignity from a fine man. You know, that's my greatest regret in my disease is the dignity that I took from him. I took no more dignity from a fine man. I treated him like an honored guest. And I've been around long enough to see some others lose the alcoholics that they love so dear. And if I had not come in and sat all the way down and followed good orderly direction from the God of my understanding and you all, I would never, ever been able to do that. And I wouldn't be okay. I know today I would not be okay if I had not consistently chosen recovery, even when it hurt, even when it was not fun, I wouldn't be okay. And today I am. You know, I miss him every day. But I'm okay because I treated him like an honored guest in every way. In every way. Ooh, okay. So today, wow. Today, I'm retired. I retired from job in healthcare. I want to tell you right quick about my last, I retired a year ago, December 30th, from a dermatology position, a histotech for a Mohs surgeon. And I happen to be OSHA coordinator and infection control coordinator at this office. And it just ended up that way. My last review, which was by and large a good review, but there was one statement from the practice owner that said, I'd like to see you be less officious with the other medical assistants. I had no idea what that word meant. So I Googled it, and oh my God, the first definition, meddlesome. Okay, managing, manipulating, meddling, martyring, mothering. I mean, oh my God, meddling. I said, God, say it ain't so. And then the next definition was offering unsolicited advice. Like, oh my God. I think I learned more from that review than any review I have ever had in my life. And that is, damn, Robin. You're still some of the sum, honey. Keep coming back. I mean, when Carol that I worked with gave me that metal star that said sheriff, well, she wasn't kidding, you know? I mean, anything worth doing is overdoing. But 180 degrees from sick is still sick. You know, I was so irresponsible that when I came into recovery, I swung right through balance into over-responsibility. So anyway, there's always a lesson. Man, God's still teaching me. He still has me by the hand. He's bringing me along as fast as I can follow. And I am so grateful to sit amongst you all. And, you know, the way I look at my life today, my very worst day today in 2020 was not a stellar year for me or anybody else. But my worst day today is 300% better than my best day ever was before Al-Anon. And so for that, I thank you all. It's an honor and a privilege. Thank you.